So this evening, we begin by preparing to look at what Jesus had to say as an exception to his rule for divorce and remarriage, and sort of setting this up, and looking at what that exception is going to be as stated by Jesus. Where has God placed acceptable sexual relationships? Within what confines?
Marriage relationship.
It's very clear in 1 Corinthians, the 7th chapter, that the husband and wife, their bodies belong to one another and not to defraud each other. Hebrews 13 and verse 4 talks about the marriage bed being held in honor and sanctified and pure, but that fornicators and adulterers God will judge. So the Hebrew writer places condemnation on fornicators and adulterers, and sometimes in Scripture they are listed separately, as in Hebrews 13 and verse 4. So define these words, and how are they alike and how are they different? Fornication and adultery. Yes?
Well, they're alike in that they're both outside the marriage.
Right.
Mm-hmm. And the fornication is pretty much towards single people. They're having sexual relations without being married to anyone. And then adultery is more for the married. They're having sexual relations outside their marriage.
Okay. That's true. Usually, especially the way we in English that we separate them, usually when we're talking about fornication, we're talking about the premarital sex, adultery, those that are married. The biblical word for fornication is a broad word that would take in adultery as well as the premarital sex. So it's a broad word. But when they're put together, obviously there's got to be some kind of distinction between the two. And the adultery would be involving at least one person that's in a marriage relationship having relations that they are not entitled to have according to the law of God. Stan?
Fornication also would include any other kind of sexual sin.
Like homosexuality and so forth, and incest, let's say bestiality, all kind of sexual misconduct with minors and so forth. All that would be within the broad context of the word fornication. So it's a broader word. But the Greeks did have a special set-apart word for adultery. And that word is found in Hebrews 13, verse 4. God has a blessing for those that are married, but it's intended to be enjoyed within the marriage relationship, not before it and not outside of it. But God understands adultery and the pain of broken vows and the attempted shared devotion. And we see that in the book of Hosea. What do we learn in Hosea there with God's experience with adultery with the nation of Israel? Yes, Stan?
They were having other gods before them and worshiping them, and sometimes even in part worshiping God and worshiping another god.
Right. Yeah, the passage in Hosea, the second chapter, talks about all the blessings, all the gifts that God had given to his bride, to the nation of Israel, and they took all the gifts that had been given to them and offered them up to idols, as if the idols had been the ones to supply the blessings. So, you know, when we take it in human terms, you know, be like all of the jewelry or nice gifts that the husband has given to the wife, and then the wife just takes them and gives them to somebody else, all the blessings that she has received, and could understand the kind of hurt that would encounter. And so God, you know, when we think about adultery, you know, it's a very emotional kind of thing, because you think about someone has betrayed the trust of another, given their devotion, even given their bodies to another person. So God lets us know that in a spiritual sense, he understands the pain of that kind of thing. In Hosea 2 and verse 2, contend with your mother, contend, for she is not my wife, I am not her husband. Let her put away her harlotry from her face and her adultery from between her breasts. So God had gotten to the point that said that she's not my wife now, because of her behavior. In essence, he divorced the nation of Israel during the time of captivity. But then as you get toward the end of Hosea, the second chapter, what does God say that he's going to do to divorced Israel? Is it going to stay that way? What's God going to do, despite the fact they were engaged in spiritual harlotry and he put them away? What's the future? Bill?
He's going to take her back, but not necessarily in the same realm, because now the new Israel will be the bride. So.
Right. Of course, yeah, we can take Hosea 2 and fast forward to the New Testament and understand more perfectly how all that worked out. But God's saying, you know, I'm not going to cast you off forever. We're going to renew our vows. You know, I'm going to make a covenant with you and take you back. And how did God prepare Hosea to deliver this kind of message? What happened in his own personal life at the instruction of God? Yes?
Had married a woman of harlotry.
Married a woman of harlotry. A woman that would go astray from him and not be true to him and devotion to him. And so he would experience the kind of hurt that God experienced as he gave this message. But then what was he told to do after experiencing this adultery from his wife, Gomer? What was he told to do in the third chapter?
Take her back.
Yeah, take her back. Go to this woman that you love, that still love. You still love her, yet she's an adulteress, but take her back. And goes on then to make the spiritual parallel that God was going to be taking Israel back. As Phil said, ultimately the most fullest way that happened is in the church in the New Testament times. And unfortunately, Israel never achieved what they could have achieved and should have achieved. And that's why ultimately God said to the nation of Israel, hey, I've got to go to a nation that's going to bring forth the fruit I've been looking for. And God ultimately just totally cast off the people of Israel and then turned to those who would obey Jesus Christ, of Jew and Gentile, to be his spiritual nation, to be his spiritual people. But at this particular time, God was being very compassionate on this side of the coming of Christ, as he had made a promise to Abraham that through his seed, all of the people of the earth would be blessed. And so God was not going to totally cut them off and destroy them, despite their spiritual adultery. But one thing that did happen as a result of this, on the other side of the captivity, they weren't idolatrous people. So this was accomplished, as it were. Those particular, they had other problems, but those particular lovers were cast aside as a result of God's discipline of his people. So I think this is important as a background to understand why that Jesus would give an exception and give this one particular exception, because we see that God himself understands the depth that kind of betrayal of trust is when it comes to adultery. So I think it gives us a backdrop to this, to, you know, when we see that there is an exception and this is what it is, then this aids our understanding in that. But as we look then at Matthew 5 and Matthew chapter 19, in both cases that Matthew records, what quotation is given to justify divorce? It's interesting that this... Well, Kenneth, go ahead.
Adultery.
What's that?
Adultery can justify divorce.
Okay, I was talking about the quotation from the Old Testament that those that wanted to promote divorce just turn to this Old Testament passage.
That's because Moses gave them the right to divorce, but Jesus said it wasn't that way from the beginning.
Right. But it seemed that they thought that Deuteronomy 24, which is quoted in both passages, it was said in Matthew chapter 5, verse 31. And of course, the Pharisees bring the same passage up. Whoever sends his wife away, let him give her a certificate of divorce. And so, looking for justification, then they, in both cases, this passage is brought up, and Jesus had to address this passage of Scripture. I want us to notice, as we sort of take an overview of Matthew, the 19th chapter, how he had avoided their trap in every respect. At first, when they brought up the question about divorcing your wife for any cause, they were trying to set Jesus against the rabbis or get him to pick one rabbi interpretation or another. And Jesus' answer is, "Have you not read?" So he didn't play into their hands. He went above their trap. He went to the beginning, like Kenneth said, back to what God had said, the origin of marriage, God's design in marriage, quoted Scripture to show that God's original intent, as we studied, was for a man and a woman to be joined together, to leave father and mother joined together for life. That's God's plan. And so Jesus gave that answer. And so that's why then they bring up in verse 7, well, what about this? What about Deuteronomy chapter 24? As I said before, I don't know if Jesus paused there and that was all he's going to say at the time, or if they just interrupted him, or how that part all worked out, because we're not given a detail. But, you know, obviously Jesus had just given him an answer from God's design. And in God's design, there was no divorce at all. So they thought he had to pick. They thought he had to pick an interpretation about divorce. And he goes back to the beginning where there was no divorce in God's design. And so then, oh, what about Moses? Well, Moses said this over here in Deuteronomy 24. And of course, Jesus, you know, so they're really pitting him against Moses, because you just went back to the beginning and you just said there's no divorce. Well, what about Moses? So now it'd be like, Jesus versus Moses kind of situation. And how are you going to get out of that? And of course, he pointed out that Moses permitted it, as has already been mentioned, because of the hardness of their hearts. He permitted it, but it wasn't commanded. It was a permission. And then the Pharisees' presentation, they said Moses commanded this and quoted Scripture. But Moses did not command it. Moses permitted it because of the hardness of their heart. So again, they would have thought they had him in a trap. Well, this is what you've just said, but this is different than what Moses had to say. And then ultimately, how Jesus avoided the trap was, "And I say unto you." He spoke with his own authority, and especially we can see that in the account of Matthew, the 5th chapter, where this subject is talked about, and many other subjects that Jesus talked about and compared the Old Testament, and especially interpretations of the Old Testament, with what he said. But as you close Matthew, the 7th chapter, and what we call the Sermon on the Mount, in which the teaching on marriage and divorce and remarriage was taught, it says, "When he finished these words, the crowds were amazed at his teaching, for he was teaching them as one having authority and not as their scribes." So, and ultimately that's the way that he addressed it in Matthew 19th chapter too. He spoke as one who had authority. You know, he quoted scripture. He weighed in on what Moses had to say, but ultimately it was, "And I say to you," which is, I can't do that tonight. Nobody here could stand here and say, "And I say to you," and that's the way it is. No, Jesus spoke with divine authority. He got up in front of people and didn't say, "Well, this is what scripture said, which is all I can do tonight, or anybody that stood up here could do tonight." But he just stood up there and said, "I say to you," and he just laid down the law, which he could do as being God in the flesh and having the authority to speak in that manner. And so this is, that's the ultimate end of how he dealt with their question. "I don't have to side with the scribe, and I'm not Moses, and Moses permitted it. I say to you, this is it." No man could do that. No mere man could do what he did. But certainly he wasn't going to be caught in a trap because he had authority to speak, to speak from God as no one else could do or has ever done, according to Hebrews, the 1st chapter, that God has spoken in his Son. God has spoken in the prophets in many ways and many times, over many times, but now he's spoken through his Son. And so what we have in Matthew, the 19th chapter, in the rule and in the exception, is directly from Jesus. And so I had you to do an exercise, and for brevity, I've just put it up here on the board. Hopefully you understood what I was trying to get across. This, if you take out the exception, it's easy to see the rule and to see the consistency with the accounts in Mark and Luke. "But I say to you that everyone who divorces his wife makes her commit adultery, and whoever marries a divorced woman commits adultery." Well, that's the same as what we saw in the parallel accounts. "And I say to you, whoever divorces his wife and marries another woman commits adultery." So it helps to, when you take the exception out of there and rewrite it, it helps to make clear again what the rule of God is. And then once you've done that, then you can go to go back and then insert the exception and make the force of the exception work in it to negate or to cancel out the consequence. And this is what I mean by that. "But I say to you, everyone who divorces his wife for the reason of unchastity does not make her commit adultery. I say to you, whoever divorces his wife for immorality and marries another woman does not commit adultery." So the force of the exception is to make the conclusion opposite of what it would be for a person who did not have the exception. So I think that helps to make things very clear as to if someone doesn't have a right to put somebody away, and this is the way it ends up. But if somebody has that right to do so, then this is the result. You're not committing adultery yourself, and you're not causing your spouse to commit adultery if you divorce them, if you have the scriptural right because adultery's been committed against you. So thoughts and comments on this. Is this clear? You understand what I was trying to do by asking you to do that in the exercise? So the part we haven't talked about so far and covered is what's mentioned in Matthew 5 and verse 32. Go back to this and leave the exception out, that everyone who divorces his wife makes her commit adultery. Explain, what does that mean? Yes, Dick.
At least puts her in a position for adulterous marriage. She's without a spouse and puts her in a position she should not have been put in.
Right, so it assumes that there's going to be a remarriage that shouldn't happen, or at least sexual activity that shouldn't happen. I was just ran across today that the vast majority of divorced people remarry within 5 years. So that, I don't know who did the statistics and gathered them, but so you would understand that if somebody without cause just divorced somebody, not for adultery, and severed that relationship, that most likely what's going to happen is what Dick said. I mean, that's what statistics show, that somebody's going to seek after somebody else that they shouldn't have, because God still views them as joined together as long as they both shall live, and they're not free to be married to somebody else. And so God is saying that if you have this divorce without a scriptural cause, then when that happens, when the woman commits adultery, obviously she's going to be held accountable for that, but so is the husband that puts her in that position. Other comment or question? Yes.
I'd never thought about this before, but you know, during that time, survival was not easy, and it could be that when you divorce your wife, you do make her commit adultery because for survival's sake, she remarries.
Right. Yeah, that is the case. Especially, it would be a great temptation in that time, as many pastors deal with widows and their situation, and young widows remarry. You know, that's going to be survival, you know, and carry out your duties instead of going around just gossiping or whatever. But yeah, and that would be survival for a young woman at that point. And of course, then the older women with a different situation, and the family and the church could help see to that in the passage. But I think that helps. 1 Timothy 5 helps us to understand the vulnerable position, especially when Jesus was speaking these words, that the woman would be in, and the temptation to enter into a relationship that she should not enter into. So when Jesus gave the exception for divorce and remarriage, did Jesus give this as a command or as a permission?
Permission.
It's a permission. It's not a necessity. It's not saying, now, if your spouse commits adultery, then you're commanded, you have to put them away. Well, the reason I ask that is the next question and follow-up: if an adulterous spouse is repentant, should the option of reconciliation be on the table before or even after a divorce? And then that's why I introduced it with Hosea, and we see God was able to take Israel back. It wasn't an easy thing, and he asked Hosea to do that with Gomer. But we see with the exception that God realizes it is really a tough ask, and I'm not going to ask it if you cannot repair the relationship and restore it. But that doesn't mean that it can't happen. And certainly there are those where it has happened and they haven't. And another reason I ask that is it's not just maybe people really can't get along and they don't want to be together and about hate each other, and they're just hoping that one of them will, you know, the spouse will be unfaithful so they can just get out of it. No, it's not that kind of a thing. And people may play all kind of games, but God is certainly not mocked. And so even if this deep hurt has happened through adultery, then there is the option of reconciling that out, and in parallel with God and Israel, if the offended spouse is able to work with that and work to reestablish trust and work to be able to continue the relationship, and then even after a divorce then that's been made because of sexual immorality, then that option is certainly on the table. And there are those that I know, and most of us know, that where that's occurred, where the injured spouse took back the adulterous spouse. And to me, it's one of the most beautiful things that can happen, that you can see. You can see where there has been able to be that much forgiveness on the part of the person that has been injured, where they're able to give it a go once again, to be like God with Israel and Hosea and betroth their spouse to them once again and renew their vows and continue on as husband and wife. So there is an exception, but it is a permission. It's not a command. It's not a necessity. But I believe, in view of all that we understand in Scripture, that it is a tough ask, and God understands that because God's been through it himself. And so that is why that this one particular thing is permitted as an exception. But Jesus' disciples implied in the end run in Matthew 19, his teaching on divorce and remarriage was too strict. What was Jesus' answer to that? Do you have to get married? Scott?
The lesson I get from this is that heaven's worth it. Marriage is incredible. All of the blessings that are associated with that are wonderful, but they're not even a drop in the bucket compared to the joys of heaven. And he talks about this one eunuch who's made himself a eunuch for the sake of the kingdom of heaven. And I think while acknowledging the difficulty of what he's saying, I think he's telling his disciples, this is worth it.
Right. And some said, you know, maybe by birth and birth defect, they could never be husband and wife in any sexual kind of way. And some were made where they couldn't really perform any sexual activity because they were, like the Ethiopian eunuch, he was a treasurer, and those in trusted positions, sometimes that was the case. But yet, as Scott is emphasizing, there are those that were, as it were, would choose, even as Paul talks about in 1 Corinthians 7, to live a celibate life, a single life, and just devote that life to service to Christ and not be married. And Paul gives the argumentation for that, and especially in the difficult times that he was writing to the Corinthians about. So, if somebody, you know, even the disciples, one just the Pharisees that said, but we met with the disciples and they said, hey, it'd be better for nobody to get married if it's that strict. But Jesus says there is an alternative. You know, if you can receive the saying, receive it, but you don't have to. But if you do choose to get married, this is the way it is. But so if a person looks at it and says, this is too tough, I could never take that on, I could never make that kind of commitment, well, then don't. I think it's Jesus' response to that. His response wasn't, let me see if I can come up with a few more exceptions. No, that wasn't, when they said, oh, this is too strict, and people just might as well not get married if it's that strict. He didn't loosen it up. He just said, his response was the opposite. Well, just don't get married. I mean, that's an option. Marriage is not a command. Marriage is a permission. Marriage is the design of God, containing many blessings for people to enter into. But you have to live within the rules if you're going to enter into it. And if you don't want to live within the rules or think you can't, then don't. So that's, you know, Jesus' answer, just like it was to the rich young ruler that couldn't give up his possessions, and he walked away sorrowful. Jesus didn't say, hey, come back. Let's make a deal. Give half your possessions away. No, Jesus let him walk. You know, so Jesus didn't loosen up the regulations on marriage because they thought it was too strict. He just said, to those that can receive it, receive it. If you can't, then don't. So, lesson five is just, we're just going to summarize it, and we can pick up here next time as well. But what do scriptural marriages look like? So those that can marry are single, widow or widower, and those divorced for immorality. And that would be, this chart sets aside 1 Corinthians 7, which is the other possibility, is that two people have been married and they've been divorced. It says stay single, or you can be reconciled. So two people that have been divorced can get back together. So that is a scriptural marriage for those that have been divorced that God still views as joined together, to get that back together once again, that relationship that had been severed, not with someone else, but with each other. The two that had been married. But other than that, single, widow, widower, those who divorce for immorality. And of course, you can have any kind of combination. A single person could marry another single person, or widow or widower, or somebody divorced for immorality. And a widow or widower would have those three choices. And one who divorces for immorality would have those three choices and end up with a scriptural combination of those that are eligible to be married in scriptural marriages. Of course, when it gets more complicated is when maybe even both parties that are married have been married many times before. I know there was a case in the congregation where I, about the second congregation where I preached, that I was teaching someone, and she'd been married three times. And I think her husband had been married before. And so once she understood what this teaching was, then she researched back in her mind, her situation. She even asked her husband, who wasn't a Christian and had no intention of being a Christian, what his circumstances were, and came up with the fact that both of them were eligible and they both could be married to each other. So it's sometimes a lot to untangle, but it can be done to figure out if one is in a scriptural marriage or not. What do adulterous marriages look like? So if someone is divorced with no exception in view, then they can't get married because they still belong to a spouse who is living. And so they can't be joined to another person, which is the definition of adultery in Romans chapter 7 and verse 3. And their only option would be to get back with the person that they're divorced from or stay single. And of course, this works both ways, you know, as well, that if you're a single person, you don't want to be marrying that divorced person because you're committing adultery too, because you're married to somebody who still has a spouse that's living. And same with a widow or widower, or one who divorces for immorality, should not be married to the divorced person, because they put themselves, as the scripture says, in adultery by doing so, by not marrying somebody that is free, that they're free to marry someone who is that God can actually do the joining. And so I think that's a lot of what we have to think about, is people that God can join together, especially living in America today. People can divorce and remarriage for no cause, no fault, or whatever, and do that as many times as they want to. That's the law of the land. And the law of the land continues to print out marriage certificate after marriage certificate for people. But that doesn't mean, when all that's happening, that God is joining those people together when men are joining people together. But in order for a marriage to be right in the sight of God, it has to be a marriage where God can join the two together. Otherwise, ends up in adultery. Well, anything as we conclude, and we can pick probably back right up with this chart as we go into next week's lesson. All right, so I know that everybody wasn't probably ready for lesson five, so we'll pick up. If you haven't completed that, complete it at home and do number six, and we'll begin by talking about lesson number five and these charts, and make sure that there's nothing we don't need to discuss further before we take on the final lesson. Number six is what to do if one finds himself in an adulterous marriage and not a marriage that is approved of God.